During my imprisonment, I had heard the password repeated 1,000 times, for my cell had been above the main gate. It might have been changed since then, and I was ready to have the captain killed as I yelled the old password at him. The mountain is high. Go across. He stood aside, and we struggled out of the throng, kicking and shoving back those who tried to follow us. We ran out onto the bridge. So urgent was the need to reach Massara that I barely noticed the drop on either hand, and without a qualm I led them across the gaping void. "Where is King Akun?" I shouted at the guards who blocked the gateway. When they hesitated, I told them, "The mountain is high. I have urgent dispatches for the king. Stand aside. Let us pass." We barged through the open gate before they could decide to oppose us, and with 12 good men at my back, I raced for the outer staircase that led to the upper terrace. There were 2 armed men at the door to Massara's chamber, and I rejoiced to see them. I had worried that the girl might have been moved to another part of the fort, but the presence of the guards assured me that she had not. "Who are you?" one of them shouted, and drew his sword. "By what authority?" He did not finish the challenge. I stepped aside and allowed Memnon and Remren to brush past me. They flew at the guards and cut them down before they could defend themselves. The door to Massara's chamber was barred from within, and when we hurled our combined weight against it, there came a chorus of feminine screams and wails from the other side. At the 3rd attempt, the door gave way, and I was propelled through the opening into the room beyond. It was in deep gloom, and I could barely make out the huddle of women in the far corner. "Massara!" I called her name, as I plucked the wig from my head and let my own hair fall around my shoulders. She recognized me by it. "Taita!" She bit the wrist of the woman who tried to hold her and ran to me. She flung both arms around my neck, and then she looked over my shoulder, and her grip slackened. Her dark eyes opened wide, and the color flooded her cheeks. Memnon had pulled off his wig. Without it, he was strikingly and unmistakably a prince. I stepped aside and left Massara standing alone. The 2 of them stared at each other. Neither of them moved or spoke for what seemed like an eternity, but was a moment only. Then Massara said softly and shyly in Egyptian, "You came. You kept your promise. I knew that you would." I think that this was the only time that I ever saw Memnon at a loss. He could only nod his head, and then I witnessed an amazing phenomenon. Blood flooded up his neck and suffused his face, so that even in the gloom of the chamber it glowed. The crown prince of Egypt, son of Pharaoh, commander of the 1st division of chariots, best of 10,000, holder of the gold of valour, stood there blushing and as tongue-tied as a peasant clod. Behind me, one of the women squawked like a startled hen, and before I could put out a hand to hold her, she had ducked under my arm and darted down the inner staircase. Her screams reverberated up the stairwell. "Guards! The enemy has broken into the east wing! Come quickly!" And almost immediately, there was a rush of booted feet on the staircase. On the instant, Memnon was transformed from the blushing young lover to a hard-faced guardsman. "Take care of her, Tata. Let no harm come to her," he told me grimly, and stepped past me to the head of the stairs. He killed the first man coming up with that classic thrust to the throat that Tunnels had taught him. Then he placed his foot in the centre of his chest. As he jerked his blade free, he kicked the dead man backwards down the stairwell. The falling corpse tumbled into the other men coming up from below and swept the stairs clean. Memnon looked at me. "Do you think we can reach the gate before they close it?" "We must," I answered. "Our best route is back down the outer staircase." "Remren, lead us. Tata and the princess in the centre. I will bring up the rear guard," he said crisply, and stabbed the next man coming up the stairs in the eye. The Ethiopian dropped his weapon and clutched his face with both hands. Memnon stabbed him again through the chest and pushed him backwards down the stairs, clearing them a second time. "Follow Remren," he shouted at me. "Don't stand there. After him, as fast as you can." I grabbed Massara's arm, but there was no need to pull her along. She came with me readily, so quick and agile that she was leading me. The sunlight struck us as we ran out onto the terrace. After the dark room, it dazzled me. I blinked to clear my vision, and then I looked across the causeway to the edge of the tableland on the far side of the gulf. Tanos' Shiluks were there. I saw their feathers dancing and their shields held high. Kajan, kill, kill, they sang. And their spearheads were dulled with fresh blood. The panic-stricken peasants scattered before them, and they reached the head of the causeway. There were 200 or 300 of Akun's soldiers there. They had the abyss at their backs, and necessity made heroes of every one of them. Now they had truly become lions. Although a score of them were driven back over the edge and plunged to their death in the valley far below, the survivors hurled back the first charge of the Shiluk. I saw Tanos then, exactly where I expected him to be, holding the centre. His helmet shone like a beacon in the dark sea of Shiluk warriors. I saw him throw back his head and begin to sing. The savage Shiluk words carried over the gulf to where I stood on the terrace of the fortress. The men around him took up the chorus, and they surged forward, still singing. This time nothing could stand before them. They stabbed and hacked their way through the defenders, and Tanos was the first man onto the causeway. He ran lightly for such a big man, and he was still singing. His Shiluk followed him onto the stone arch, but it was so narrow that they were forced into single file. Tanos was halfway across when the song died on his lips and he stopped. From the gateway of Adbar Seged, below where I stood, another man stepped out onto the causeway to confront Tanos. I was looking down and so could not see his face, but there was no mistaking the weapon in his right hand. The blue sword caught the sunlight and flashed like a sheet of summer lightning. Akun, Tanos bellowed, I have been looking for you. Akun could not understand the words, but the sense of them was unmistakable. He laughed into the wind, and his beard blew out like smoke around his goatee face. I know you. He swung the silver blade around his head, and it hissed and whined in the air. This time I will kill you. He started forward, out along the narrow arch of stones, running with long, lithe strides straight at Tanos. Tanos altered his grip on the handle of his bronze shield and tucked his head in behind it. He now knew the power in that glittering blade, and I saw that he did not intend meeting it with his own softer bronze. Akun had also learned discretion from their last brief encounter. From the way he carried the blue sword, I guessed that he would not attempt another rash overhand stroke. As they came together, Akun gathered himself. I saw his shoulders brace and his weight swing forward. He used the impetus of his charge to send the straight thrust at Tanos' head. Tanos lifted the shield and caught the blue blade in the centre of the heavy bronze target. It would have snapped a sword of inferior metal, but the blue sword sheared through it as if it were goatskin. Half its silver length was buried in the yellow bronze. Then I realized Tanos' intention. He twisted the shield at an angle so that the blade was trapped. Akun struggled to withdraw his weapon. He wrestled and heaved, throwing his full weight backwards, but Tanos had the blue sword in a vice of bronze. Akun gathered all his strength and pulled back again. This time Tanos did not resist him. He leapt forward in the direction that Akun was heaving, and this unexpected move threw Akun off balance. Akun staggered away, tripped, and teetered on the brink of the chasm. In order to keep his balance, he was forced to relinquish his grip on the hilt of the blue sword, and to leave it still embedded in the shield. He windmilled his arms as he swayed out over the drop. Then Tanos shifted his ground, put his shoulder behind the shield, and barged forward. The shield crashed into Akun's chest, and the pommel of the blue sword caught him in the pit of his belly, with all Tanos' weight and strength behind it. Akun was thrown backwards, out into empty space. He turned a slow somersault in the air and then went straight down, with his robe ballooning around him, and his beard streaming like a chariot pennant in the wind of his fall. From where I stood, I watched him make the same last journey on which he had sent so many other unfortunate souls. From the causeway until he struck the rocks 1,000 feet below, he screamed all the way down on a high, receding note that was cut off abruptly at the end. Tanos stood alone in the middle of the causeway. He still held the shield on high, with the sword buried in the metal. Slowly the tumult and the fighting died away. The Ethiopians had seen their king vanquished and cast down. Their heart went out of them. They threw down their weapons and grovelled for mercy. The Egyptian officers were able to save some of them from the blood-crazed Shiluk, and these were dragged away to where the slave masters waited to bind them. I had no eyes for any of this, for I was watching Tanus out there on the bridge. He began to walk towards the gateway of the fortress, and the men cheered him and raised their weapons in salute. "There's plenty of fight in the old bull yet," Memnon laughed in admiration. But I did not laugh with him. I felt the chill premonition of some awful tragedy, like the air stirred by the beat of vultures' wings as they settle to their gruesome feast. "Tanus," I whispered. He walked with a slow and hampered gait. He lowered the shield as he came down the bridge of stone, and only then did I see the stain spreading on his breastplate. I thrust Massara into Memnon's arms and ran down the outer staircase. The Ethiopian guards at the gate tried to surrender their weapons to me, but I pushed my way past them and ran out onto the causeway. Tanus saw me running towards him, and he smiled at me, but the smile was lopsided. He stopped walking, and slowly his legs buckled beneath him, and he sat down heavily in the middle of the bridge. I dropped on my knees beside him and saw the rent in the crocodile skin of his breastplate. Blood oozed from it, and I knew that the blue sword had bitten deeper than I had believed possible. Akun had driven the point through the bronze shield, on through the tough leather breastplate, and into Tanus' chest. Carefully I undid the straps that held his armour and lifted away the breastplate. Tanus and I both looked down at the wound. It was a penetrating slit, the exact width of the blade, like a tiny mouth with wet red lips. Every breath that Tanus drew frothed through that horrid opening in a rash of pink bubbles. It was a lung wound, but I could not bring myself to say it. No man can survive a sword cut through one of his lungs. "You are wounded." It was an asinine remark, and I could not look at his face as I said it. "No, old friend, I am not wounded," he said softly. "I am killed."